Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Theology on Tuesday. Go ahead and grab a seat. We're going to get started. There's plenty of pizza still there, and there's water in the back. I know Clark stepped out, but he'll be back soon. Welcome to Theology on Tuesday. My name is Justin. This is my friend Brian. We're delighted that you're with us this evening. We're excited for our conversation. I want to draw your attention to these little sheets of paper around the room. You can ask any question you'd like this evening. We have a topic that we're going to talk about for a little bit, but then after that, you can submit, or really during that time or after that time, you can submit any question you want. Go ahead and like the questions that you see on there in that top QR code. You can see the questions that are of interest to you. Go ahead and like those, and I think John is our moderator this evening. He'll pose some of those questions. We'll do our best to answer as many of them as we can. You can join our email list, which is the primary way that we just give updates about what's going on and when we're meeting, that sort of thing. You can scan that bottom left QR code there. And then there are a few announcements. Obviously, a bunch of services that are on there. We're both at St. Philip's. There's plenty of other churches. If you're interested in going somewhere else, we can help you there. But this next week is actually what we're going to be talking about tonight.
That's right.
So there are a whole list there in terms of the schedule of some services that you can take advantage of right here at St. Philip's, the Brown Church, with all the scaffolding on it right now. There is an opportunity, if you want to serve, we have an opportunity for you to do that this coming Saturday, or no, sorry, April 19th. You can join some folks and go serve at Star Gospel Mission. It's a wonderful outreach where they try to provide care for those in transition who've fallen on rough times and to help turn their lives around. You can join them 9 a.m. April 19th at Star Gospel Mission. And then I think Alexandra is here. Yeah, there she is, right here. If you are looking for some more opportunities to hang out with other like-minded folks in their 20s or 30s, this is a great opportunity for you in Holy City Life. That is that bottom right QR code there. Just an opportunity outside of this. I think I saw something about trivia coming up, and that is, I believe, the next thing that'll be on the docket. But lots of fun things, ways to connect and continue on the relationships that you start here. So, Brian, tonight we are going to talk about Holy Week. What is Holy Week? Or are there any other announcements? I always need to ask.
No, I think that's good.
Okay,
yes.
Fantastic. That's rare. What is Holy Week, and why should we talk about it?
Yeah, so Holy Week is the time that Christians commemorate the last week of Jesus of Nazareth's earthly life. So starting with his triumphal entry into Jerusalem, going through the Last Supper and his betrayal and then his crucifixion and then his rising from the dead on Easter Sunday. And so that is the time period. And part of the reason that it is so important is that if you look at the primary documents for Christianity, which are the four Gospels that we have in the New Testament, anywhere from a quarter to a third of those Gospels are focused on that one week. Out of all of Jesus's life on this earth, they're focused on that one week, which might tell you that it's pretty important. So that is why we are talking about it.
Isn't it like half of John's gospel,
yep,
something like that, is devoted just to the last 7 days,
yep,
of Jesus's life? What would you say to folks, maybe they're not from a liturgical tradition, maybe they're not even Christian at all, how you mark your time, I guess, like, most Christians agree Christmas and Easter are important days, but 7 days, really? Like, why? And you mentioned Palm Sunday, I guess, starts it off, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes all the way through Easter. Does everyone have to follow this? If not, what's the big deal in following the 7 days, that sort of thing?
Yeah.
What would you say to those who are just really new to it, I guess?
Yeah, I would say if you are new to it, you have been missing something that is really wonderful and amazing. Because part of what is so incredible about Holy Week is that because of the Gospels and the tradition of the church, we have so much information about what that last week of Jesus' life was like. We know what happened on each day, and we are embodied creatures. And so the tradition of Holy Week, one of the expressions that's very often used is to walk the path of Holy Week. And Jesus literally walked the path of Holy Week. And very early in Christian history, within a couple of decades of Jesus's resurrection, people would go to Jerusalem and they would walk literally the path of Holy Week to these different sites in Jerusalem while the Romans were running the city. And this grew and grew, and finally when Jerusalem fell, people were unable to go. And so in Europe, they started doing these pilgrimages, these walks around the churches and in different towns. And that's where a practice called Stations of the Cross that we'll talk about in a minute came from. But I think it is the opportunity to literally write yourself into a play, to write yourself into a play and to walk and experience all of the emotions, to experience all of the beauty and the horror of this week. And it is a way of entering into the story. And we are people who are profoundly shaped by our imaginations. We learn a lot more from stories than we do from lectures. And this is a way that we can literally walk a story, and it will transform what the celebration of Easter feels like if you have walked the path of Holy Week.
Yeah, did I hear you right that it was decades after Jesus that these practices in Jerusalem started?
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
The research I came across was like, certainly by like the 300s and that sort of thing, you had a lot of people coming to Jerusalem, they gave evidence of this, but I didn't know that. That's amazing. But I going back to what you were talking about and being embodied, right? Like, we're all, this is one of the things we've talked about many times before, is how you mark your time, the things that you do, they actually subconsciously shape what's going on under the hood in your own heart and mind. And you just have to think about other major holidays that you celebrate, probably. Mother's Day, Father's Day. These things that are in many ways designed to inculcate values in us, right? And so marking our time as Christians is a strategic way that we can actually begin to have the things of the Bible begin to permeate our hearts and our minds, and it becomes second nature. And I think, boy, what a privilege it would have been to be actually in that very place and to have it come alive. But it's so neat that it began to go out as pilgrims went and then went back to their homes. They began to utilize the scriptures that we have, right? I mean, we have so much of those last 7 days, as you mentioned. We have a pretty full account of what it looks like. And so we're able to reenact it in a pretty amazing way where we can enter ourselves into the story. But you know, there's a huge difference between just hearing a message and then actually going and experiencing, reenacting it, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I think the biggest thing, I mean, you did this right before I got to St. Philip's, but it was in COVID, where, you know, we both have been in the liturgical tradition for a while, where Holy Week is kind of second nature. And speak a little bit about how jarring it was for you. During COVID, we had to film services so that they would be edited and then go out so that people could watch them. This was right at, you know, March, April of 2020 was right when everything was going down, and people had their cell phones. They were trying to figure out how to record this stuff to get it to their parishioners. But I think, was it you or somebody else? It was before I got there, but you were filming Easter on Good Friday, right?
Yep.
Can you speak a little bit about what that was like doing and just how abrupt?
Yeah, well, it was really weird on all sorts of levels. So the whole thing was weird. Holy Week was so weird because there's no one in the church, but we're preaching. And so I was preaching, I think, on Good Friday, and something kept going wrong with the technology. So I literally preached the sermon three times in a row before it like finally actually took. But then we like changed everything out and put flowers out, and then it was Easter, like on the same day.
Like minutes later?
Yeah, and it was just, the whole thing was just so surreal. And the fact that there was no one there, and it made you realize how valuable it is to walk each day through that period, to have worship, that has a different shape each one of those days. One of the things about Holy Week is there's this huge transition that happens, because if you know the story very well about Palm Sunday, Jesus comes into Jerusalem and is hailed as like the conquering victor, and it's amazing and joyous and all of that. And then all of a sudden, the tables begin to turn and they're plotting to arrest him. And then finally, it moves toward the Passover feast, where Jesus and his disciples have this last Passover supper together. And there's this amazing conversation that happens. And then Jesus is betrayed and is in the Garden of Gethsemane, is arrested. And then the next day is Good Friday, where he is executed on the cross. And we have different liturgies for each one of these things that really, with music and all that, that really enables you to emotionally connect with what is going on. And this is a really bad example, so you just have to pardon me for saying this. But one of the reasons that Harry Potter World is so popular, especially if you go to the one in the UK, is that people love the stories of Harry Potter, and they want to go and experience what Diagon Alley is like, what Hogwarts is like, and to walk through these recreations of these buildings. And that's part of, we are wired that way in our souls to long for stories that move us to be able to enter into them. And Holy Week is so much more than Harry Potter. You know, you're entering into something that is a beautiful, moving story, but it's true, that actually happened. And to be able to walk into that and experience a lot of the elements of the liturgies that we use, you know, they're hymns that go back to the 300s. It's just, it's an amazing experience to be able to walk through all of that.
Well, part of the genius, too, of J.K. Rowling and Harry Potter is that each of the seven books are the same sequence, right? Mm-hmm. It always begins with coming into the... It's almost like a liturgical year,
yep.
so to speak,
yep.
where the start of the school semester begins, and then it goes through it. Like, it's the same sequence of events in all seven books. And there's something interesting about, you know, Holy Week forces you... you know, Lent is those 40 days leading up, and we think about Jesus' temptation in the desert for 40 days. We don't really have a whole lot of the information that happened in each of those 40 days. But for one rare moment of the year, we have to actually slow down, where it's not just, oh, it's Good Friday, now it's Easter, when the
yep.
flowers are up minutes
yep.
later. But your sequence of events, night and day, day and night, the same chronology of Jesus is mirrored in your own
right.
life. And
yes.
there's something about slowing down for that and going according to it. It's just powerful and helps you to meditate and get into the story.
Yeah.
As opposed to just, again, hearing about it in outside of a particular sequence of time.
Yeah, and part of what is so cool about it is that we're not only entering into what it was like for Jesus to walk through that last week, but we're entering into the fulfillment of all of the prophecy that's in the Old Testament. And one of the things that is crazy is there are all of these writings in the Old Testament that point toward Holy Week. So, for example, most scholars think that the Psalms were written 1200 to 1000 BC. Psalm 22 describes pretty graphically what crucifixion is like, and talks about someone like a Messiah being crucified. And that's written before crucifixion had ever even been invented. Isaiah 53, written in the 7th century BC, talks about this Messiah who is beaten, and where all this whole sequence of events happens is exactly what happened to Jesus. It really is quite extraordinary. And then on Palm Sunday, the people are chanting and saying, Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, Hosanna to the Son of David. And what they're shouting is from Psalm 118, which again is written 1,000 years before. And the religious leaders come up and say, Jesus and disciples, stop people from yelling that. And the reason they say that is that everyone in Judaism knew that that was a psalm about when the Messiah was coming. And so when they're chanting that, they're saying, we believe Jesus is the one promised all through the Old Testament. And so in Holy Week, you are entering into all of that fulfillment of all of those prophecies as well. So there's a lot of richness to that.
Yeah, you mean, I'd love to kind of go into the flow of the 7 days of Holy Week. You mentioned Palm Sunday especially and coming in there. I think that would be helpful to kind of trace that story and the significance of it.
Yeah, so basically what happens is Jesus and his disciples come into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, and the scriptures recount that there are these huge crowds of people, and they're waving palms, and they are chanting and welcoming Jesus, throwing down their cloaks for his donkey to walk on, so many things. And there's a lot of beauty and joy and sort of triumph as Jesus enters in. One of the things that's really cool is there's a hymn that's traditionally sung that's called All Glory, Laud, and Honor that I think was written in the 300s. It's been sung on Palm Sundays for well over 1,500 years. It's just amazing. But it quickly turns because Jesus goes to the temple and the Pharisees are plotting about how to kill him and how to arrest him and looking for the moment. So you know that they're looking for the moment. And then the next couple of days, you see Jesus preparing for this final supper with his disciples and teaching and talking about his kingdom and how it's not the kingdom of this world. And then you see finally on Thursday, which is called Maundy Thursday, and that comes from the Latin word mandamus or mandare, which means to command. And that is the result of the fact that Jesus at the Last Supper, part of his teaching is he says, a new commandment I give you, that you love one another as I have loved you. And so in the church tradition, we have a big service on Palm Sunday. We have smaller services Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, where we are hearing the stories of Jesus's interactions with people leading up to this Last Supper. And then on Maundy Thursday, we have some more amazing hymns where we celebrate Holy Communion being given as a gift to us. And then at the end of the service, we commemorate Jesus's being left alone when all the disciples fled when he's arrested. And that service ends with the whole altar and everything in the church being stripped, all the lights being turned out, and the minister reading the account that ends with, and they all left him and fled. And then the last light that the preacher's using to read goes out, and it's pitch dark. And then everyone leaves. And then the next day, Good Friday, there's a service in the middle of the day that recounts Jesus's crucifixion at the noon hour. And then later in the day, there's Stations of the Cross, where we will have several hundred people gathered. We have 14 stations that correspond to from Jesus's arrest to picking up his cross, walking toward Golgotha, the words he says, the things that happen, the nails being driven into him, and his death. And we have a little icon set up in the churchyard, and we literally walk from one place to the next, and the choir is singing in between each station. It's very moving. And then at the end of that, again, we leave in silence, and then we wait, just as all of the disciples waited, for the joy of Easter morning.
Yeah. One of the things that's so jarring when just hearing you say that, like the beginning of the week where they're cheering. I think this is one of the things that I, just growing up, I didn't quite understand how in such a short period of time they could go from celebrating and the palm branches being a sign of national pride and triumph to shouts of crucify him 5 days later. And that was something that I think just really stands out to me as you go through, and I think Palm Sunday, Maundy Thursday, and Good Friday, each those services, even more so than Easter, mm-hmm. are filled with imagery and significance that is pretty jarring in the service,
yes.
at least, especially Maundy Thursday. But I think that recognition that, I mean, how would you explain to somebody, like, how in the world, why were they celebratory of somebody and then 5 days later shout those same people shouting crucify him?
Yeah, so I think a lot of that goes to, I don't know how many of y'all are so young. You probably don't remember Depeche Mode, but Depeche Mode used to be a really popular band, and they have this song called Your Own Personal Jesus. And that's sort of the issue, that people in Jesus's time, they had this idea that what the Messiah was going to do was to kick off the end of the Romans. And the Romans oppressed the Jewish people. They were an occupying power in Judea and Israel, and they were hated by the Jewish people. And there was a strain of thought that what the Messiah was going to do was to be a military leader who would start a revolution that would throw the Romans out. But it became very clear over the course of the week that Jesus was not remotely interested in being that kind of Messiah. And his teaching and everything else that he did made it very clear that his mission was to save his people from their sins. And people were not so interested in that. And then the power structure kicked in and saw Jesus as a threat and wanted to do everything in its power to be able to silence him. So it's sort of the combination of those two things takes what had been a hopeful time and turns it into what, at least at the first part, looks like a tragedy.
Yeah, yeah. In the Bible study that I was a part of this morning, we were looking in Luke 9, and one of the central questions there, but I would say the central question of Holy Week is, who is Jesus? Like, this is one of the most important questions you could ever ask. Who is this Jesus?
Yep.
And that was, you know, one of the things that was so crazy in Luke 9. Peter confesses that Jesus is the Christ, but as you just described, he has no idea what that means.
Yeah.
And then Jesus says, oh, by the way, the Christ and Messiah, those are, I guess Messiah is Hebrew and Christ is Greek.
Right, it means anointed.
Anointed
one.
Yeah. Like the king. And the king was the triumphant one who is going to destroy, militarily overthrow any sort of oppressors. Kind of like what Israel in its golden glory days of David. And so everyone is expecting a Messiah around 30, 20, 10 BC, and then Jesus appears, and there's so much excitement, and the Passover being this time that I thought it was going to happen, and it just becomes like disenchantment. But he tells his disciples, and the three, but especially the 12, back in Luke 9, that I'm going to go and suffer and die. And their first response is, no. And secondly, we didn't really sign up for that. That was not what the program was we were getting behind. And it has something to say to each of us, especially as we walk in the footsteps of Jesus throughout this week, is two questions. Who is Jesus? But what does it mean to follow in his footsteps when that's the kind of kingdom that he's about?
Yes. Yes. And I think the other part of that that is so important is that when you are looking at Holy Week, all of the people, even Jesus' closest followers, as you were just saying, Jesus told them that he was going to be handed over to evil men, that he would suffer and die, and then be raised again on the third day. And they just really didn't like anything about that message, because part of it was their own ambition. They thought, we're in on the ground floor with the guy that's going to kick out the Romans, and when he comes into power, we're going to be the vice president, the secretary of state, you know, all
of
that.
Let me sit on your left and your right.
You know, I'm going to go buy a new car, you know, all that kind of stuff. But the problem with that was that was not at all what Jesus was saying. He said, I'm going to die, and then he said, and then I'm going to be raised on the third day. But one of the things we don't get, because we're on the other side of all this, is we don't get that they did not understand that. Mm-hmm. And one of the things the Gospels say several times is when, you know, we'll say Jesus said, and I'll be raised on the third day. And the next verse is in parentheses, and it says, and his followers discussed among themselves what rising from the dead might mean. Because it clearly didn't mean rising from the dead, because people don't rise from the dead. So they thought this was some sort of spiritual metaphor or something like that. But what is so easy to miss when you read these stories is that when Jesus died on the cross, they all thought that was the end, that it was over, that they had really blown it because they had given up everything to follow Jesus and invested everything of their life in following him, and now he had been put to death and probably they were next. And that's their framework. And the only people who didn't flee were John and a few of the women. And so on Easter morning, they went to the tomb to go anoint Jesus's dead body. And they fully expected that there would be a dead body in the tomb. They did not think that Jesus was going to rise from the dead. And when they get there and see the stone rolled away, they think it's grave robbers. And they become even more upset. And then they can't get their head around when the angel says he is risen. And then when he appears, I love this phrase in one of the Gospels where it says, when he came in to the disciples, it said they disbelieved for joy. And what the Greek basically says is they couldn't believe it. It was so amazing that it had happened and that it was true. And they were so full of joy, but they didn't understand how it could possibly have happened. And so they're just caught in this disbelief and yet joyous state.
Mm. Yeah, they supposed him to be the gardener at first. They could not understand that this was, in fact, the risen physical Jesus. And that attests to the fact that he truly did die. It wasn't this, there's all these theories that have been proposed that maybe one of the greatest, pulls on people ever, that maybe he didn't fully die and then maybe his disciples took it, but the Gospels, if you read them carefully, and there's been great work done on this. What was the New Testament book that you talked about? Williams?
Yes, so Can We Trust the Gospels?
Yeah, that one.
Yes.
But
if you haven't read that, please read it. It's amazing.
But there are all these places in the Gospels, especially in Good Friday and Easter Sunday, that go at great lengths to show this really did happen. The Roman guard that was set there was because rumors were his disciples might try to steal this body, and it was their necks on the line if his body was gone, and that's exactly what happened. And so the historical evidence of it is overwhelming. And I'd love just to hear in the final minutes that we have, what are some ways for folks, both maybe somebody who's new to Holy Week, who might, what can you practically do to make the most out of it, but maybe somebody who's been doing it for some time and is maybe feeling a little dry by it. What kind of breath of life can invigorate their experience of Holy Week?
Yeah, I think that's such a great question. So I would say one of the best things you can do is to literally walk the path and go to a service every day, whether it be at St. Philip's or somewhere else. If you go to a service every day, most of us are not used to going to church every day of the week. If you go every day of the week, that will just put you in a different place. And if you go into a liturgical church that observes these different things that have happened, that will be really transformative. Going to a Stations of the Cross service on Good Friday is something else that can be transformative. I think looking at if you go to services, keeping the bulletin and looking at the words of the hymns and the prayers. So many of the hymns and the prayers that are used during Holy Week are well over 1,000 years old. And to think about people back in the, early medieval period, and then going back some of the hymns even to the Roman period, that you're entering into the stream of these same words about these events that people have been singing for centuries and centuries can be very life-giving and moving. So I think those are all things that can help. Another thing that's great to do is to read, I would say especially John's Gospel, and start around chapter 10 or 11 and just read straight through to the end and do that every day for Holy Week.
Read all of John 11 through the end each day?
Yeah.
Okay, I was going to suggest, why don't you read each event of the day? Maybe.
Well, you could do that, too. You could do that,
you're
too,
just
but
holier
it's not
am.
That long.
No, I appreciate it. Yeah, walking through, going to church, I mean, there's not that many places that actually offer something every day, as you mentioned, and that can be a benefit just as a discipline for 7 days to see what it's like. But at the very least, trying to read through the scriptures and those events and just meditating on it, thinking about what was this like, putting yourself, envisioning that scene and that story, There's all sorts of study Bibles that can help you kind of paint that picture as to what this would have been like. Do you have a favorite part of Holy Week as we wrap up?
I would say it's a tie between Maundy Thursday and Stations of the Cross.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think both of those are just really amazing times to think about. And one of the things I love in Maundy Thursday is the fact that it is the Last Supper, and that out of all the things that Jesus could have chosen to be a sacrament to bring his people together to worship him, that he chose a meal that we share together where he is teaching about what it means to love one another and to lay down one's life for one's friends. I think that's just really incredibly moving.
That whole service is, as I think it's the most visually dramatic of
striking.
All of them, right?
Yeah.
And in fact, I know we got a few folks from St. Michael's. That was where I was a youth minister at a time. And they, I mean, he really led the service in such a way that, like, you start, and it's this wonderful, intimate, joyous time where you're celebrating the Last Supper, remembering how the Jesus washed his disciples' feet. And then you start taking all of the hangings and the beauty, as you described, kind of all the pieces of furniture out of the church,
yep.
And it just becomes empty,
and
dark.
Bare.
And I will never forget what, and I don't know if you can tell me if they still do this at St. Michael's, but they end up having a giant chain and locking the altar area, and it just sank, and it was so, you feel so sad, but it sets the tone for Jesus's arrest, his betrayal by Judas, and then his crucifixion the next day. But that was certainly one of my favorite parts of Holy Week, is Maundy Thursday. One of the things that's grown for me too is there's a tradition. Anybody been to an Easter Vigil before? I see one hand, two hands. I've been to one. That's a really cool service. The cathedral, I think, does one. Cathedral of St. Luke and St. Paul. That is on a Saturday night. And I went to one of those with my now wife at the time. And we went, and I was like, so
wife
angry.
At the time.
She's my wife now. At the time, wait, what did I say?
Yeah, you didn't mean to do that.
You didn't mean that.
All right. No, at the time.
At the
then,
time, you
she's
went
my
with
wife,
your wife
now.
Yes.
I was with. Yeah, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I've had one wife, thankfully, happily married. So, we were at her church, and it was the first time I went to an Easter Vigil, and it was Saturday night after dark, and that was when historically that was the great vigil of Easter, and so they'd start to celebrate Easter, because I think in the Jewish understanding, the night was
right,
the start of the
Sunday.
Next day.
Yep.
Yeah, and so that was crazy to me, because that service is also, like Maundy Thursday, very visually dramatic. And so they start in the dark, and the fire comes in, and then they go through all of salvation history and read Genesis up to the coming of Christ. And then the lights come on in the middle of the service, and there's flowers, and I was like, wait, it's not Sunday yet. Why are we celebrating? This is very strange. But there's something sweet about that, because that was historically a time, especially on Saturday, where catechumens, those who have been preparing to be they'd be baptized and brought to their first communion, would be on Easter Sunday,
mm-hmm.
or in that Easter Vigil service. And that's become a part of my favorite part of Holy Week, is the baptisms that happen on
mm-hmm.
Saturday, and then communion when they can take the meal of the family of faith on Easter Sunday. It's special. So at this point, I think we'll probably throw it. How are we doing on questions, John?
We're doing all right.
Okay.
If you want to take the time to go ahead and upvote some of the questions that you like to be asked, and also this is an opportunity for you to ask a question.
And one thing I'll throw out while y'all are doing that is that if you don't really know whether you believe whether all this happened or not, I would really encourage you to do some reading and try to learn more about that. One of the things that a lot of people don't realize is that there is a tremendous amount of secular evidence for Jesus's existence, his death on the cross, and for the fact that his disciples believed that he had risen from the dead. And reading Peter Williams' book, Can We Trust the Gospels, reading the old classic Frank Morrison's Who Moved the Stone, reading Lee Strobel's Cold Case Christianity, any of those are really good sources to go to for that.
Yeah. That's good.
All right. First question. Let's discuss Synod of Whitney and why Anglicans follow Roman Catholic calculation of Easter. Wasn't Christianity in England before Rome?
That is a fairly arcane question, I would say.
I think everybody's dying to know
I'm
the
sure
answer.
I'm sure all of y'all know what the Synod of Whitby is, and have probably lain awake at night wondering about it. But basically, so yes, Christianity came to England in the Roman era in the first century, and Christianity grew like wildfire in England in the Roman period. By the 300s, there was a conference in France that there were multiple bishops from England that went to this conference. And then Christianity spread into Ireland in the 400s. And then there were invasions in England, and the Irish came back and kind of re-evangelized. And then in 597, Augustine came to Canterbury from the Pope, thinking that England needed to be converted, and was surprised to discover that there were already all of these Christians. So there were some differences between the Christianity that grew up in England and the Christianity that had come from Rome, not major differences in terms of beliefs, but in terms of some of the practices. So the Synod of Whitby was basically bringing both sides to the table and sort of figuring out how to go forward. And the basic answer to the question is there were compromises about different things. I don't know what their rationale was for choosing that particular way of calculating, but all of the Western Church, other anything that is not part of the Orthodox community, agrees on that calculation of Easter now.
And we're talking about when to commemorate a day during the time of the year. So, you know, I think most people would agree that December 25th was most likely not the day of the year that Jesus would have been born. It was probably in the springtime, but most accounts that I've read, it's not a matter that is absolutely important when you commemorate the day. And to make it even more arcane, today, this year, Orthodox Easter and Easter, according to the Western Rite,
are the same.
Same day.
Yes.
So it doesn't really matter this year.
Yes.
But
points for knowing what the Synod of Whitby was. So good for you.
Yes. Yes.
What are your thoughts on the recent evidence that confirmed the location of the crucifixion?
I haven't seen this. Have you?
I'm not sure which one of those it might be, but I think that the basic point is that the more biblical archaeological digs are done around sites that are mentioned in the New Testament, or for that matter, the Old Testament, the more archaeological investigation there is, the more accurate the scriptures have been proven to be. That more and more evidence points to the fact that the scriptures are right. This is not specifically about the site of the crucifixion, but one of the things that was a major, major discovery in recent years was the pool at Bethsaida, which is described in the Gospels, the place where Jesus healed this man. But the way it's described was very unusual, and not the way that these pools were usually built in terms of the number of colonnades. And so many, many scholars had said, it's just wrong in the Gospels. They didn't understand and got messed up somehow. But then they did an archaeological dig within the past decade or so and discovered the pool, and it's exactly as it was described in the scriptures.
As a Protestant, what's the value in more traditional Catholic practices that emphasize embodiment, like pilgrimages, iconography, etc.?
I would say that all of those things are hugely valuable, and I think that there are many Protestants that embrace those, maybe not in the exactly the same way in terms of icons. But I also think that there's a lot of misunderstanding about that in some parts of the Protestant world. Really, even in the Orthodox practice, the purpose of an icon is not to venerate the icon, but to see through the icon to what the icon represents. And I think that the Protestant tradition can fully embody things like pilgrimages, things like art, and all of that. So there have been times in the Protestant and certain parts of the Protestant church that have rejected that, but I would say particularly in the Anglican world, all those things are very much part of our faith and practice.
Yeah. I think this might be an oversimplification. I'm curious what you think about it, but Protestants or evangelicals, that word evangelical just comes from evangelion, meaning gospel. The proclamation of the gospel is always done through the preaching of the word. In Romans, you have, how can they believe unless they hear? And how can they hear unless somebody is sent preaching the gospel? So the importance, and this is what Protestants do well, is they focus on the word. And that's really important, especially in conversion and evangelism, basically. What I think can be helpful is in discipleship, which is really about a lifestyle, there, it's still word-centered, but recognizing what you do and how you live your life will ultimately have an effect on your heart and what you love. You can see that easily by how subconsciously our cell phones train us to do certain things, right? Like what your little habits nudge you to do affects what you think and love. And in that sense, I think there's wisdom that can be had, not in a slavish kind of, you know, if I just do these things and check the box, like I'm guaranteed to be good. But when you apply these ancient practices and try to live into it, there can be rich spiritual benefit where you begin to love that which you want to love more and follow him in every way. And I think that's right. I mean, the institution of the Lord's Supper was during Holy Week, the Maundy Thursday service. And thank goodness that the Lord Jesus himself saw us, and it wasn't just that we needed to hear about his love, but he gives us bread and wine so that we can taste and smell and see and be physically reminded and assured of his love for us. And we don't just have to hear. I mean, think of a husband and a wife who only said, I love you, but never embraced, right? This is what some of these, the sacraments especially, but then the practices that involve the more physical existence can be a more robust, not in a salvation sense, but they can aid as you're talking about what you ultimately love.
Yeah, and that whole idea that I think the Catholic tradition did a much better job of holding on to in some periods than the Protestants did is that truth, beauty, and goodness are part and parcel of what it means to worship God. And if you let those go, you are living an impoverished kind of Christian life.
Well, that's why, yeah, I think now just the beauty of some of those rituals or the beauty of the space itself is the appeal, because we live in a world that's so disenchanted. It's good.
How do you shift from reading the Bible to know God more?
I assume in the sense of just getting to know more information to move in a direction to be able to actually love God, I'm guessing is the way this question is. One of the things is just the discipline of doing less reading. I would prefer you to do less reading as long as you asked the question and invited the Lord to come into and say, what are you saying to me in this?
Yep. Yep.
There can be a danger, I think, in just trying to read yourself into the story. But so it's important to know, what did this mean then? What does this tell me then about who God is, who Jesus is, and what does it mean to be human? Those basic questions are important to help understand, but then to apply it, you need to invite the Lord to say, I know you are sending your spirit. I'm here to follow after you. Would you then show me what you have for me in this? And I think just that discipline of, I'll be willing to sit for several minutes and just wait to get a sense of what, and if he brings an image or any sort of the part of the scriptures that stand out, that can be important to kind of lean into, I think. But that's one of the ways to start.
Yeah, I think that's really good. And I would say the other aspect of that is to lean into worship. And I don't mean by that just going to church. That's obviously important. But part of going to church is preparing to worship. And I think a lot of times we're not very good at that. It used to be in our tradition that the understanding was that you would get to church a little bit early before the service started. You would kneel in silence for a while and ask the Lord to prepare your heart and to open your ears to hear and to tune your heart to worship him. And I think so often now we run in right before the service starts and we're sort of not fully present in the service. But I think really leaning into worship by being fully present and asking God to speak to us through worship, that is also an important counterpart to all of that.
And kind of going off of that, the worship element of reading the word is prayer, I would say. So the oftentimes, to kind of say the opposite of what I just said, like we can want to know, God, what are you saying to me right now to do? And that's a good question. But there's an important element, too, of just adoring God for who he is. And I think when you begin to read scripture and then pray it back, thanking God for who he is, adoring him, praising him, even as you're reading the scripture, is actually the pinnacle of devotion and, and prayer, as opposed to just the vending machine approach of God. Is, I'm just going to ask him this, but actually spending time to just marvel in who he is based on what he has said about himself.
What is your favorite movie or documentary or series about Jesus?
Oh, wow.
I was actually wondering about this question. I was assuming The Chosen is probably one of those that is on many people's minds. And I think that's probably the best answer I can give. I still don't feel super great all the time about The Chosen and trying to follow any real depiction of Jesus. It just fails to capture it exactly the way the scriptures are. And that by design, it's artistic license. They're doing their best to fill in the story. But that's a pretty good one, and I like The Chosen.
Yeah, I like The Chosen, too. I think there's some things The Chosen gets really right that usually are gotten wrong, so I really appreciate that. One is that even though they're not quite as young as they should be, Jesus' disciples in The Chosen are young. They're not grizzled old men like you usually see in stained glass windows. One of the things that we know, and scholars know this, and yet it hasn't affected the way disciples are usually depicted, the disciples were always younger than the rabbi. And so Jesus dying at age 33, the disciples are clearly younger than that. Probably some of them are still in their teens. And you get that in The Chosen. The other thing that you get is that there's joy and laughter, and I really appreciate that. I would say for me, although it has got some major flaws, Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ is really good. I think that it really helps you to feel like you are right there in the midst of it, and I think that is something that is very powerful.
How could we gather together with the Palestinians as there is all this genocide on both sides? Is the Holy Land meant for all people? Can you provide guidance?
Palestinians, is that what the question
is?
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. If we could provide guidance on that, we
could. Be in the White House.
Yeah. Yes, we would be ruling the world. But I do think that one of the things that Christians are, and Jews too, are enjoined to pray for the peace of Jerusalem. That is in the Psalms. We're enjoined to pray for the peace of Jerusalem. I think probably it's fair to say most of us don't do that on a regular basis. But I think it is tragic how much brokenness there is around the Holy Land. I think in a practical matter, there's not a lot that most of us can do here in Charleston to change the course of world events about that. But I do think one of the things that we can do is pray. I think one of the things that we can try to do is to love people that are on both sides of the issue there and to pray for them to be able to see truth and to seek after peace.
Yeah, I don't really have anything to add to that. It's pretty good.
How to approach people who claim to be a Christian but deny a literal resurrection to avoid a miracle claim?
That is a great question. And that is one of the great challenges, I think, for Christians in the past 100 years. There has been an explosion of this idea that you can be a Christian and not believe in the supernatural. And the problem with that is a view that is absolutely divorced from the witness of Scripture. I mean, I just don't think, if you hold to the idea that there is no such thing as a miracle, and that God didn't intervene, and that the resurrection didn't really happen. I think you have to say that the traditionally understood definition of Christian does not apply to you. Paul is very clear in the epistles that the resurrection is the central fact and tenet of Christian belief. And if you don't believe that that happened, what Paul says, if Christ has not been raised from the dead, then we are of all men most to be pitied. And so it's really the hinge of Christianity. It's in the creeds. If you can't say the creeds without crossing your fingers, something's wrong.
Yeah. When you think about the resurrection, you think about the incarnation or creation. All three of those moments are miraculous.
And supernatural.
And supernatural.
Yeah.
And I think that's, yeah, there's just no way to read the Bible and to actually follow the historic Christian faith in any meaningful and intellectually honest way and try to say, well, there's a way to do that, and you have to radically change what you mean by Christian in a way that it's never meant up to this point.
Yeah.
And some of the folks today are trying to, you know, those hardcore atheists, Richard Dawkins or whatever, like nominal Christians, but they don't believe in God. I don't know if this is what this question is getting back to. But they see the value of what the Christian movement
does. Christian civilization is better than any alternative.
Yeah. And they're close to seeing, like, well, that's good, but that's still not technically what a Christian is. You have to believe in a creator and a creature. And if you can believe that God is God, that by definition, he can do what he pleases, create the world, take on flesh, rise from the dead because he's God, that's one of the central things it means to be a supernatural, theistic religion altogether, I think.
Yeah, and I think if you are friends with someone who is in that camp, who feels that way, if they are someone who reads, I would give them C.S. Lewis's book, Miracles, which is exactly on point for that.
How can you see the Exodus played out in Holy Week?
Oh, that's a fun one.
Yeah.
Yeah. So somebody, again, bonus points for knowing that Holy Week is about a new Exodus, right? So I don't know. My mind goes to Maundy Thursday because what were they celebrating that evening? Was the Passover feast.
Yep.
The
lamb.
The Gospel of John tells us that the sacrifice, he was on the cross at the time of the sacrifice, is that right? Or was it the other Gospels? I can't remember. But the actual time that Jesus hung on the cross was significant because that was
when
the moment
lambs are being slaughtered.
The lambs being slaughtered, the moment of deliverance for the passing over from death to life, and ultimately on Easter Sunday where new life is experienced in a new promised land where you're free from the tyranny of Satan, sin, and death.
Yeah, and one of my favorite theological concepts, that I'm going to restrain myself here, but there's a theological concept called types and shadows, and it's basically the idea that everything in the Old Testament is a type or a shadow of a true reality, just in the same way that a building casts a shadow. This true reality casts a shadow, and the Exodus is a shadow of what happens through Jesus' crucifixion on the cross, the lamb who was slain from all time, all of that. And so all of what I would say is that that is pointing toward a fulfillment that is what Jesus does during Holy Week.
One of my favorite, I think it's Augustine who says, the Old Testament is like a dark room. Like imagine being in this room, it's completely dark. All the furniture is still here. And you're going along, you bump into that couch or that chair or that staircase. And in the New Testament, it's like the lights come on. What was already all there is now in plain view.
And I think you see how it's all connected.
Yeah, and that's what he's talking about. And that Exodus in the book of Exodus is very much pointing towards Holy Week.
Yep.
Maybe one more?
That was the last question.
Oh, for
okay,
real?
Well.
Okay. Well, guys, thanks so much for coming out. We are right at about 8:30. Join us for Holy Week. Find a church. Go. That'd be great. We'll be back the week after Holy Week because we're going to be doing Holy Week during Holy Week. But right. We'll be back the following in 2 weeks from today, back in here. We'd love to have you join us. Thanks for coming out.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah.